and to say a few words, I'd point to the fact that Sri Aurobindo is drawing out these stages in the ascent of consciousness, actually in the key of knowledge. So it's a matter of how we move from the relative uncertainty of our mental sort of understanding to greater degrees of knowledge, certitude of knowledge. And one thing to understand over here is that this scale, like other kinds of, is a relative one. Relative in the sense that depending on how you wish to understand this ascent, you would configure these symbols or these formulae in a slightly different manner. What I mean is made more clear if we think about another way of looking at this whole journey, ascent, which is talked about, for example, in the idea of the formation of manifest things out of the unmanifest, which arises out of certain Upanishads, for example. And in this description, there is a slightly different scale that is followed, in which one may think of a movement that goes from what is called the ether of Yom, whose primary manifestation is vibration, is pure vibration, which is related to sound. And then that moves into a second level, which is likened to space or air or wind, Vayu, the god Vayu of the vital world. And with it is associated polarity, positive and negative, and vibration, which is in some sense a continuum, breaks into the push and pull of various kinds of actions that arise out of polarity. A third level of manifestation. Now this level again is associated, as I said, with the power of wind or of breath. A third level would proceed from the notion of fire or light, and this is connected with the eye and with seeing. Fourth level is where this goes further into a density of manifestation which is liquid, and in this liquid state, you know, commonly called water or up, the notion is that a manifestation takes place in the form of fluidity, but more properly in the form of subjective experience or rasa. And finally, you have a density of experience which is completely concrete and material, and this medium drops to matter. And here the form of manifestation is experienced in terms of the dispersion of rasa as smell, gandha. So we find, if you look at this scale, we find that this is a scale of experience. A scale of experience that ultimately has some match with what we are studying. But it's not an exact one-on-one match. So, for example, we don't. He doesn't raise the issue of rasa over here. Those of you who sort of studied during the intensive a couple of weeks back, Record of Yoga Intensive, we covered the notion of rasa arising out of the subjective existence. So our first access to spirit in the subjective realm could be said to arise from taste or experience, which belongs to the notion of, to the worlds of experiences of of smell and taste, gandha and ratha. And then we move to a purity of sight, which belongs to, you know, fire over here in that case. And then to a realm of touch, and finally a realm of sound. Now, if we take this particular scale of experience and try to map it to this scale of knowledge, we find that there is a loose fit. Knowledge as internal knowledge, if we move from the knowledge of the senses to the knowledge of the inner senses, our intuitions that arise in the vital, our first access to a deeper knowledge can come from intuitions of a inner mind perception that is related to aesthetics, to what is known as taste in that aesthetic sense, ratha. From that we rise to a higher level which is more cosmic and move gradually to pure thought, that is the knowledge of a philosopher. From that we can rise to an even greater clarity of pure seeing, which is visionary in nature. And so far we are moving almost in tandem or in sort of the same scale as the scale that we've studied in the knowledge of, in the development or evolution of knowledge. Then we rise in this scale of experience to a level which is likened to touch. Now, here is where we find that the understanding of the scale of knowledge, we move to an area from vision, which is again close to touch, which is the intuition. The intuition is something which relates to inner touch, a touch, a mental touch, you may say, or a spiritual touch. It's intimacy of concreteness. Finally, in that scale, we move to a power of hearing. Now, here is where the scale changes a little bit, because hearing is not given that great a status in this other scale of experience. But we may be able to see that what is being called hearing in the notion of the journey of manifestation and its experience is ultimately purity which is undivided. It's from the realm of touch, from the realm of positive and negative, of the push and pull, of the vital, of what is called wind or vayu, that we begin to have the idea of division, of duality. In the realm of the continuum of sound, of the beginning of the waves of the Om, we find that there is no breakage of that continuity, and we are rising into a cosmic consciousness. From that point of view, there is a match between what we find in this one scale of experience and the other scale of knowledge. If we look at it that way, we find that there is a one-to-one correspondence. Now, the other thing to note is that as we rise, these powers which are related to the inner senses start becoming more comprehensive and integrated. So, for example, with the illumined mind, if we can talk of the power of vision, direct vision, and then with the intuition, if we can talk of the power of direct touch, it is not really a direct touch which is lacking in vision. It's as if it is working from behind the vision. The power of pure thought or cognition of the higher mind, the power of pure vision of the illumined mind are both contained and superseded by the power of inner touch, which we find with the intuition. Similarly, if we talk about the power of pure sound, which is in over mind, we find that again contains it's this inclusiveness in which we can't really talk. I mean, to talk about these as senses, manner of speaking. That's one thing to realize. These formulae given, for example, in a variety of mystic literature, each is a journey, is a certain path, and we shouldn't take these too literally. They can be reconfigured if thought of in some other way. And the higher we go, the more inclusive this becomes. Now, that is also brought to our attention in that paragraph before the one on the overmind, where he's talking about the intuition. And in that paragraph, he shows how the intuition contains in itself the visionary power, the auditory power, the thought power, and the power of touch, as well as of discrimination, of differentiation. You can see intuition has a fourfold power. Power of revelatory truth-seeing, a power of inspiration or truth-hearing, a power of truth-touch or immediate seizing of significance, which is akin to the ordinary nature of its intervention in our mental intelligence, a power of true and automatic discrimination of the orderly and exact relation of truth to truth. So cognition, touch, seeing and hearing are again contained and integrated in the intuition. Again, in each of these four powers can be configured in a hierarchy which is not absolute and which depends on how we approach this journey. So from mysticism to mysticism, we may have slightly different scales in the hierarchy of our experience. I wanted to make that point because that is related to a certain relativism that is bestowed upon our creation through the overmind.
Devajisa, somehow I don't recollect discussing this, what the points that you made last time, but very interesting list. And it seems that what you're saying is that each of the scales from the mind to the overmind, they have corresponding, they have some kind of a loose, fluid correspondence in the outer senses. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I agree that this entire discussion did not arise earlier. I think it was Keka who sent me some correspondence and opened up this discussion with me separately.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, this arises essentially out of the ability of each of the senses to map to some power of knowledge, ultimately integrating themselves in the overmind.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishta.
Oh, Devashishta?
Yes.
I really liked the reading last week. The first chapter is, I just really like it. It kind of motivated me to do some more reading. And I picked up The Life Divine and I read the last part, the last chapter in book one, Supermind Mind and the Overmind Maya.
Yeah.
And then I read a few other chapters and I found out that he had written them about the same time as he wrote the chapter that we're working on. I don't know, it was really nice from an intellectual kind of philosophical point of view. I mean, to me, the overmind was always very dry and, I'm sorry, but it was kind of, just like an impediment. I mean, as I read about it on the way to the supermind, but somehow the chapters just opened up to me the place of the overmind and the ascent, and just, it was just very powerful. It's very nice to realize that the function of the old mind is to like bring stuff out and develop them to their fullest of their exclusive aspect. And it was really nice. I was sitting in a coffee shop thinking about that, and there was a bunch of, I know there's a bunch of people in there, two different readings. They're like born-again Christians or whatever. But just for a minute, I got a, just had this really nice feeling of everybody like aspiring towards the same thing. But we see it in different ways and in terms of conflict, but the other way of seeing it, just that everybody's working towards the same thing, and if you can get above that a bit and just see all the different aspects of people's aspirations, it's just very nice. I like this chapter.
Yeah, quite true. Actually, it is very true that, I mean, from one certain point of view, wherever people are, there is a certain aspiration that is being made to progress along its own path by something which oversees everything and which gives allowance to plural approaches towards its own, source. That's ultimately coming from the overmind, and the higher one gets in even receiving some glint of that cosmicity, the easier it is to, see how, this diversity, from the viewpoint of the overmind, how this diversity, even in terms of its conflicts, is ultimately rising towards something which is harmonious. You're quite right. The other thing to keep in mind is that this scale of knowledge is not necessarily the scale of mystic experience, because mystic experience can occur at any particular level of the scale, and also tends to scale a kind of a higher height closer to the overmind as an experience, not as a form of knowledge as such. Mystic experience may not be motivated by the seeking for greater knowledge. It may just be motivated by a tremendous effusion or inspiration for the universal. For the one being there is. So it may happen that, one misses these runs, as it were, and just sort of jumps into something cosmic or quasi-cosmic. And in this jump, there is a certain sense of isolation, a sense of rupture, a sense as if there is no connection between our condition and that condition. And this is not abnormal. This is quite, empirically sort of the way things happen to most people. But what he's pointing out is that there is a scale and a connection by which a regular ladder or almost a kind of a hierarchy of growth of consciousness can be approached. And that is what these various rungs that he's talking about, comprise of. But there is a certain dichotomy between each of these rungs and the overmind. That dichotomy comes from the fact that right up to intuition, what one receives may be more or less narrow. There may be a sense of something wider, but wideness is not... an entire, it may be more penetrating than wide. It may configure itself differently to different people. But when one really, I'm talking about not really residing in these planes, which are all aspects of cosmic mind, but receiving messages and inspirations from these planes, which may be in some sense not as if one were to either rise into overmind or receive direct intimations from the overmind. That's why that paragraph on the overmind, he makes that point very clearly that its primary characteristic is the sense of cosmic consciousness, and that until and unless it has been prepared in us, it is not possible either to be, you know, kind of generally open to this consciousness, nor to rise into this consciousness as one's natural state, which is what he's aiming at here. Yes, Vince.
I kind of had a little feeling that we talked in the intensive about, I think we did, about meditating on the one or on oneness. I kind of think that helps. At least it makes me feel happy when I read these.
No, that's exactly the point he's making, that, you know, to arrive even at cosmic consciousness, that sense of the one has to persist in us. So, you know, it has to become something regularized, not the sense of something which is a rupture from our everyday existence, but a sense of something which is integrated in our everyday existence. And perhaps this meditation on the one at all times is one of the most powerful ways to integrate this experience and bring the cosmic consciousness close to our everyday experience.
Sitaram, would you like to start reading? So this is page 951, the paragraph starting with, but there can be many formulations.
But there can be many formulations of your mind. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I think we lost two people dropped off, right?
Yeah, they were not online anymore. Jyoti and Bindu. I'll add them when they come.
I'm sorry, what page are we on?
This is page 951 and the paragraph starts with, but there can be many formulations.
In the other book it is page number 988.
Okay, thank you.
But there can be many formulations of overmind, consciousness and experience. For the overmind has a great plasticity and is a field of multiple possibilities. In place of an uncentered and unplaced diffusion, there may be the sense of the universe in oneself or as oneself. But there too, this self is not the ego. It is an extension of a free and pure essential self-consciousness, or it is an identification with the all. The extension or the identification constituting a cosmic being, a universal individual. In one state of the cosmic consciousness, there is an individual included in the cosmos, but identifying himself with all in it. With the things and beings, with the thought and sense, the joy and grief of others. In another state, there is an inclusion of beings in oneself and a reality of their life as part of one's own being. Often, there is no rule or governance of the immense movement, but a free play of universal nature to which what was personal being responds with a passive acceptance or a dynamic identity, while yet the spirit remains free and undisturbed by any bondage to the reactions of this passivity or this universal and impersonal identification and sympathy. But with a strong influence or full action of overmind, a very integral sense of governance, a complete supporting or overruling presence and direction of the cosmic self or the Ishvara can come in and become normal, or a special center may be revealed or created, overtopping and dominating the physical instrument, individual in fact of existence, but impersonal in feeling and recognized by a precognition as something instrumental to the action of the transcendent and universal being. In the transition towards the supermind, this centralizing action tends towards the discovery of a true individual replacing the dead ego, a being who is in his essence one with the Supreme Self, one with the universe in extension, and yet a cosmic center and circumference of the specialized action of the infinite.
So we had done this paragraph before, but I thought it might be useful to revisit, because these paragraphs on overmind are so dense and in some sense are so important. I wanted to draw attention to what he's talking about once again as a result of looking at it once again. So here he's pointing to firstly the flexibility and the vastness of this overmind consciousness, in which a variety of kinds of cosmic experience can be had. They would all belong in a sense to this cosmic consciousness, though they may be experienced differently. Again, it's an example of that same idea that there is one reality, but the sages think of it or speak of it differently. Now, the way he talks about it, though, is also very important to recognize in terms of the transition from a normal ego-centric existence to an existence in which the ego gets shattered. And we discussed this earlier also, that experiences of this kind can at least temporarily disorient the sense of central individuality that we find ourselves with normally. Now, what happens as a result is described by him in a number of alternate scenarios, but also these scenarios are linked to one another and form almost like a kind of a succession, or a kind of hierarchy, if one might use that term. So in one case, he's talking about an existence in which the individual retains a sense of individuality, but it's a sense of loose individuality that kind of identifies itself with whatever is around it. It's almost as if one can become identified with anything around it without the ability to separate oneself from it. This kind of reception or receptivity is in some ways quite precarious and painful, an overall hypersensitive condition. But this is what is happening to the Prakriti. It's the universalization of the Prakriti that has taken place. Behind it also there is the universalization of Purusha, which initially may see itself as something which, stands behind every individual existence. but gradually comes to get the sense that all existences are carried within it. This is the gradual emergence of the cosmic Purusha. Idea, then the other thing is that if the full-fledged sense of the experience comes when there is the sense that everything, all beings are contained in oneself, that that sense of self which one is experiencing is this inclusive self which loosely forms the envelope or container, continent of all other selves. Now, there is still no sense of I within that though. That is, there is no sense of, there may be a sense of I which is very loose, like an Atman, but there is no sense of controller of Prakriti. And there is a kind of receptivity, the receptivity which is allowing all kinds of cosmic waves of nature to be received as if experiences flowing into one's being. So this is how he shows this particular kind of condition. This condition is one in which the primordial differentiation of Purusha and Prakriti is still maintained. This is one of the primary divisions of what is known as the ignorance or avidya, that soul and nature, or this experiencing self which is receiving all these experiences, and that which holds the instrument of experience, that is the Purusha, which witnesses, which stands behind and which contains the instrumentality, are two separate things. It is because there is a cosmic power to the Purusha that a tremendous cosmic capacity of experience is present in the instrument. This is what happens, but the two are still sensed as separate. One is just there holding the basis of experience, and the other is experiencing. Now, both have the cosmic status to them. Now, further, he talks about another stage in which the Ishvara starts evolving or emerging. That is another sense of I. Now, here is where there is the possibility or danger that usually a condition of cosmic consciousness may, you know, it's very difficult to stay in this state. So it might fall back into a condition in which there is a reversion to the older self. Now, that may happen, and yet there may be a switching back and forth along this ladder of experience till ultimately there is a stabilization in some state of more universal self. Now, the universal self that he's talking about, which ultimately, embodies or fully expresses the cosmic consciousness, or what he's calling overmind over here, is one in which the Ishvara comes to the front. The Ishvara unites the Purusha and the Prakriti. The Ishvara is the capacity of Purusha to see Prakriti as something it can control or command, so that the experiences are then channeled. The instrument is under the guidance and control of a self. Now, this transition is often a very difficult one. That is because ultimately Ishvara does not belong to overmind proper. Ishvara really, even when Ishvara arises in overmind, its power of control of the instrument is only limited. It's only limited to the sense of instrumentality that the individual contains. But at the same time, there is a certain cosmicity to the experience which cannot completely be controlled by this sense of self. So here is where the Ishvara is really a gradual, a progressive emergence of the supramental self, a supramental Purusha. That's why he's talking about it in terms of a transition towards the supermind. In the transition towards the supermind, this centralizing action tends towards the discovery of a true individual replacing the dead ego, a being who is in his essence one with the supreme self, one with the universe in extension, and yet a cosmic center and circumference of the specialized action of the infinite. So it is only in the emergence of this true person that the integral yoga begins to complete itself. So too, the whole idea of evolution that he has introduced begins to complete itself, because ultimately the evolution is the integration of the Supreme Person. The whole dismemberment, the sacrifice of the Purusha is reintegrated in the integral person, who is the supramental Purusha.
So, Devajita, before the Purusha is activated, when Prakriti is having its play, there is no central controlling theme, is it? It's just independent forces having their way based on whatever is stronger in a certain Aadhar?
Yeah, sort of. There's a cosmic power to Prakriti also. Prakriti is acting in a cosmic vein. So, you know, cosmic Purusha and cosmic Prakriti are being embodied, so to say, at the individual level. That's why he's saying over here, often there is no rule or governance of the immense movement, but a free play of universal nature, to which what was the personal being responds with a passive acceptance or dynamic identity, while yet the spirit remains free and undisturbed by any bondage to the reactions of this passivity, of this universal and impersonal identification and sympathy. See? Mm-hmm. So this is the condition when the two are separate. But we find that gradually there is a power of governance that emerges. But with the strong influence of full action of the overmind, a very integral sense of governance, a complete supporting or overruling presence and direction of the cosmic self or the Ishvara can come in and become normal. Or a special center may be revealed, etc. And then he points out that this really is a progression leading to the emergence of the supramental Purusha, because that is the true Ishvara.
So another question is, thank you, Devashisda. Another question is that, so when he speaks of the Sakshi and the Anumanta as the stages before the Ishvara, are they like forms of the Ishvara, or are they separate quote-unquote powers or actions in themselves?
No, they are forms of the Ishvara. In fact, one is say that, you know, there is only one Purusha. Ultimately, everything can be boiled down to there is only one Purusha or Purushottama. And that has a variety of multiple self-concentration, which gives the impression of many Purushas, which is the basis of each one of our existence. And that, again, in the ignorance is experienced through a variety of its own powers, limited, self-limited, one may say, in various degrees. So its first level of self-limitation is in the ignorance as something which is asleep. Then it is awake, but only a witness, Sakshi. Then it recognizes, it gathers itself into a giver of choice, you know, of sanction, that is the Anumanta. Up until this point, we have various aspects of the same Purusha, which are operating within the ignorance. So Purusha and Prakriti are separate, and Purusha only has limited power over Prakriti. Up and this kind of condition persists up to the overmind. It's only at the heights of the overmind that Anumanta passes into Ishvara, and we get the full knowledge of the integral being, which is both Purusha and Prakriti at once.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha. Vince, would you like to read the next one?
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it's good.
These are the general first results and create the normal foundation of the overmind consciousness in the evolved spiritual being, but its varieties and developments are innumerable. The consciousness that thus acts is experienced as a consciousness of light and truth, a power, force, action, full of light and truth, and a basis and sensation of beauty and delight, universal and multitudinous in detail, in illumination in the whole and in all things, in the one movement, in all movements, with a constant extension and play of possibilities which is infinite, even in its multitude of determinations, endless and indeterminable. If the power of an ordering overmind gnosis intervenes, then there is a cosmic structure of the consciousness in action. But this is not like the rigid mental structures. It is plastic, organic, something that can grow and develop and stretch into the infinite. All spiritual experiences are taken up and become habitual and normal to the new nature. All essential experiences belonging to the mind, life, body are taken up and spiritualized, transmuted and felt as forms of the consciousness, delight, power of the infinite existence. Intuition, illumined sight and thought enlarge themselves. Their substance assumes a greater substantiality, mass, energy. Their movement is more comprehensive, global, many-faceted, more wide and potent in its truth force. The whole nature, knowledge, aesthesis, sympathy, feeling, dynamism become more catholic, all understanding, all embracing, cosmic, infinite.
So this paragraph also we had considered last time, and here he is talking about the integration phase of the overmind. Note that he uses the term overmind gnosis over here, an ordering overmind gnosis. This gnosis, of course, is an integral knowledge. Gnosis implies a power of knowledge that puts everything in place, sees everything as a whole. So here again, this relates to the end of the previous paragraph, where he's talking about the emergence of the Ishvara. Emergence of the Ishvara or Lord consciousness, the consciousness of the Lord, of the divine person, is related to this idea of a cosmic ordering intelligence. So that is the overmind gnosis. So here, however, it's very important to recognize that this ordering intelligence is not the kind of order that human mind can understand or encompass. Every form of human mental order tends to become a kind of ideology, an ideology that creates a certain distinction between what is allowable and what is not allowable within the totality of things. Now, this schema is not the overmind schema. The overmind schema includes everything in the cosmos as part of its ordering mechanism. In this sense of ordering, the truth of everything, since nothing that exists, nothing which doesn't have a truth, the truth of everything is given its place. So this is part of the overmind gnosis and its action, everything is seen as an aspect of the divine which is evolving, including the contrary aspects which deny the divine, which is what we may call the existence of falsehood and evil. I mean, quite apart from ideological falsehood and evil, even cosmic falsehood and evil. So even at that level, at the level of the overmind gnosis, there is the allowance of every one of these realities as symbolic realities in the cosmos, and a full giving of play to each one of these. So that is the nature of the ordering power of this infinite consciousness, which sees and puts in place from the overmind gnosis.
So when we say that they are given their play, does that mean that they simply appear in the mental constructs, or does it also mean that they get manifested in physical nature also?
Yeah, no, not mental constructs. You see, now we have to look at it two different ways. Mind you, as he's pointing out, the higher we go in the scale of the cosmic mind, the more control these planes have on the other planes, that is, even from intuition, at the level of intuition, there is sufficient awakening of this particular plane in the vital and the physical, so that we can talk of a vital intuition and a physical intuition, which is quite independent of mental intuition, but originates in the plane of intuition, cosmic plane of intuition. So too, when we talk about overmind gnosis, we are talking about something that acts independently at the physical and the vital level, creating orders at these levels also. See? So it is not just in the mind that this is happening. It's also happening at every level of existence. Cosmic overmental power is a tremendous sort of cosmic power. However, it is not completely invincible. You see, this is the point that he'll make. The reason being that there remains a certain relativism to the action of the overmind. That's why I was saying that overmind puts in place everything within the symbolic reality of a creation that has already been given a certain truth. That is, if falsehood has a certain truth in it, if the idea of a denier of truth has a certain symbolic value in it, that value is not abolished. That value is also given its full right to exist within that cosmic scheme. This is not merely in the mind, but in the mind, vital and physical reality. Up until the level of the overmind, it is seen very clearly what the various powers of existence are symbolizing, and what their true place is, how they play a part in the overall evolution, and yet there isn't any power to change these apart from the energy that makes them all evolve towards the truth.
I guess there was the place that I have the doubt about is that it seems that many of these may be very opposing ideas, correct? Like they may be able to exist only exclusively. So how does that get, you know, really it's going to be more of a struggle for their place rather than simply that they all get their free play, isn't it?
Yeah, that is true, but you have to see it like this, that if the inner reality gradually moves into a certain condition in which the same play is going on, which includes the play of opposition, strife, and struggle, but there is a sense, a universal power of oneness underneath it, then this becomes a different kind of play. It's no longer a play of the mask of things, but the play of the reality of things that wears masks. You see, so that becomes the perception and action of the overmind. The perception and action of the overmind in an individual or in a collective, in an overmental world, does not necessarily change the character of the play, but it does change the consciousness of the play. In other words, it's almost as if now we know that this is a play going on, right? And that one being is playing this play. That the players of the play, that masks that people wear in the act and the nature of the drama are not changed. See? Mm-hmm. That is one way of understanding it. The struggle continues and opposition is there. But two things are there that happen as a result. One change that takes place is that a lot of the things that seem to be conflicts are resolved into harmonious associations. And some things which seem to be conflicts retain their nature as conflict, but are seen to be the play of the one through conflict.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishta.
Yeah, I know that this is it's a difficult concept to stomach, actually.
Yeah.
Also, there is the notion that, I mean, we find that, let's take the very, obvious kind of problems that we are faced with, problems of different ideologies that are pitted against each other, each one claiming to be the only way to truth. Now, that kind of problem will disappear a long time before one fully enters the overmind, because it will be perceived that these are various formulations of the one truth. That perception is inherent to even intuition, or even before that. But even further in the overmind, there will be certain symbols, symbolic realities that represent the ignorance and the contested power of ignorance in reality, in the ignorance, and that will remain what it is, in a sense, but be known for what it is. That is the way in which things will change at the level of overmind.
Yeah, thank yeah.
This is one of the reasons why Sri Aurobindo felt that though the overmind was a great power, if it was experienced, it really gave answers to everything, but it did not transform the world. Remember, we started off earlier talking about movement or transition from law of Rudra to law of Vishnu.
Mm-hmm.
Both these, law of Rudra and law of Vishnu, could be considered to be two possibilities in overmind. But if the law of Rudra was manifesting in the world, if that was what the world was embodying, overmental gnosis would not change it. It would require an even higher power to change the name of the game, one may say. So, to move from the law of Rudra to the law of Vishnu, it would require a transition to something else that took the decision to change this particular, real idea of what is called the ignorance and turn it into an unveiled play of truth, which is what we call the law of Vishnu.
Monica, would you like to read next?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, it's good.
Okay. The overmind change is the final consummating movement of the dynamic spiritual transformation. It is the highest possible status dynamics of the spirit in the spiritual mind plane. It takes up all that is in the three steps below it and raises their characteristic workings to their highest and largest power, adding to them a universal wideness of consciousness and force, a harmonious concert of knowledge, a more manifold delight of being. But there are certain reasons arising from its own characteristic status and power that prevent it from being the final possibility of spiritual evolution. It is a power, though the highest power of the lower hemisphere, although its basis is a cosmic unity. Its action is an action of division and interaction, an action taking its stand on play of the multiplicity. Its play is like that of all mind, a play of possibilities, although it acts not in the ignorance, but in the knowledge of truth of these possibilities. Yet it works them out through their own independent evolution of their powers. It acts in each cosmic formula according to the fundamental meaning of that formula, and is not a power for a dynamic transcendence. Here in earth life, it has to work upon a cosmic formula whose basis is the entire nations, which results from the separation of mind, life and matter from their own source and supreme origin. Overmind can bridge that division up to the point at which separative mind enters into overmind and becomes a part of its action. It can unite individual mind with cosmic mind on its highest plane, equate individual and cosmic self, and give to the nature an action of universality. But it cannot lead mind beyond itself. And in this world of original inconscience, it cannot dynamize the transcendence. For it is the supermind alone that is the supreme self-determining truth action and the direct power of manifestation of that transcendence. If then the action of evolutionary nature ended here, the overmind having carried the consciousness to the point of vast illumined universality and an organized play of this wide and potent spiritual awareness of utter existence, force, consciousness and delight would only go farther by an opening of the gates of spirit into upper hemisphere and a will to enable the soul to depart out of its cosmic formation into transcendence.
So this is, as we had just discussed, the limitations of the overmind that you are in those beings. It is the highest power of the lower hemisphere. This lower hemisphere term is of course taken from the Upanishadic distinction between vidya and avidya, or knowledge and ignorance, as being that belonging to the higher hemisphere and the lower hemisphere, Paradha and Upper Ardha. So this lower hemisphere essentially is marked by ignorance, and it is not the place of overmind to overcome the ignorance. Therefore, this is why I said it operates a kind of radical relativism. This is the very essence of overmind. Everything, every particular formulation is given its right to existence and also given its ability to evolve its right to existence. Now, as a cosmic evolution occurs, such an allowance of relativism moves towards a creation that is not necessarily discordant, but that at its height becomes a creation of harmony. It's a harmony of many powers of truth, each one very, very different from something else, but coexisting with it in its own domain, and ultimately everything finds its domain and its harmonious coexistence. But the special powers that cannot be overcome, because they also have their right to exist. Hello? Hello, can anybody? Can I be heard?
Yes, there was a little bit of disturbance for a few seconds, but by and large it's okay. Only for a few seconds there was a little bit of a disturbance.
Can you hear me now, Janet? Hello? Janet, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay. So ability of each of these relative realities to exist and evolve by themselves is something that ultimately yields a certain kind of a harmonious coexistence. Though even within it, there are points of contest, as he says, nescience of darkness of the existence of non-existence, if one might call it that. Because ultimately, the meaning of death, the symbolic meaning of death and even of matter as a inconscient formulation is as a symbol or formula of non-existence. And that is given a certain right to remain within an ignorant creation, within a cosmic creation, which is bounded by the overmind. So these problems remain. They are not overcome. That's why what he's saying is that it is the highest term of the lower hemisphere. But having arrived there, there is also the possibility of the emergence of a greater power of transcendence, which can ultimately transform this entire lower hemisphere. And that is one of the precepts of what Sri Aurobindo's whole thesis is about, which is that evolution ultimately yields this power to transform what seems to be a condition of eternal existence, which is the notion of ignorance in which we find ourselves.
I have a question. It says in a paragraph that it cannot lead mind beyond itself. Can you explain that a little bit more? What that means, that it cannot lead mind beyond itself?
Yeah. Now, you're actually, what you have to look at, think of over here is that, let me explain it like this, Janet, that firstly, we find ourselves as having minds, okay, that the mind is a certain faculty that we experience. But, of course, human mind is only a province of a larger cosmic mind, which is what he's talking about over here. But even if we talk about a cosmic mind, that cosmic mind is like a projecting faculty. That's why he's saying its essence is division and interaction. So let me give you a certain kind of an image that might help us to grapple with this. If we have a projector that is projecting a movie onto a screen, that projector is actually taking something, an idea, some kind of another story which is recorded onto some sort of medium and translating it into a form that can be projected. If we take this analogy back in existence, a certain power that takes from universal or transcendental infinite existence that can create many different formulations of the universe, but has the power to project it into reality would be mind. Mind is constrained by the power of differentiation. It has already differentiated the unitary light into certain figures. And those figures are now going to be interacting with one another. So that is the basis of cosmic existence. So it's almost as if now we are saying, can we go beyond the projector into that which the projector is sending out? So that would be the limitation of the mind, in a way.
So mind is inherently limited by the nature of itself.
Exactly.
Okay. And also, briefly, what is inconscience, the term inconscience?
The term inconscience and it is ultimately that which does not have consciousness, or that which hides consciousness to such a degree that it doesn't express any consciousness. So one would think of matter, for example, but in Sri Aurobindo's scheme, matter itself is only one formulation of the inconscient. So inconscient would be a principle, a sort of spiritual principle, in which consciousness has gone to sleep. In its material, in its manifestation, it would have, one of its manifestations would be matter.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Louise, would you like to read next?
All right. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
In the terrestrial evolution itself, the overmind descent would not be able to transform wholly the inconsciousness. All that it could do would be to transform in each man the touch, the whole conscious being, inner and outer, personal and universally impersonal, into his own stuff, and impose that upon the ignorant, illuminating it into cosmic truth and knowledge. But a basis of essence would remain. It would be as if a sun and a system were to shine out in an original darkness of space and illuminate everything as far as its rays could reach, so that all that dwelt in the light would feel as if no darkness were there at all in their experience of existence. But outside that sphere or expanse of experience, the original darkness would still be there, and since all things are possible in an overmind structure, could re-invade the island of light created within its empire. Moreover, since overmind deals with different possibilities, its natural action would be to develop the separate possibility of one or more or numerous dynamic spiritual formulations to their utmost, or combine or harmonize several possibilities together. But this would be a creation or a number of creations in the original terrestrial creation, each complete in its separate existence. The evolved spiritual individual would be there. There might evolve also a spiritual community or communities in the same world as mental man and the vital being of the animal, but each working out of its independent existence in a loose, related relation within the terrestrial formula. The supreme power of the principle of unity, taking all diversities into itself and controlling them as parts of the unity, which must be the law of the new evolutionary consciousness, would not as yet be there. Also, by this much evolution, there could be no security against the downward pull or gravitation of inconsciousness, which dissolves all the formations that life and mind build in it, swallows all things that arise out of it or are imposed upon it, and disintegrates them into their original matter. The liberation from this pull of the inconscient and a secured basis for a continuous divine or Gnostic evolution would only be achieved by a descent of the supermind into the terrestrial formula, bringing into it the supreme law and light and dynamis of the spirit, and penetrating with it and transforming the inconscience of the material basis. A last transition from overmind to supermind and its descent of supermind must therefore intervene at this stage of evolutionary nature.
So he's making more elaborate this distinction that we have been discussing. And he's also leading to this difficult understanding of why it's necessary to move into what he has called the third of the triple transformations. The first transformation was the psychic transformation. The second is the spiritual transformation. And the third is the supramental transformation. So this is the spiritual transformation that he is talking about. And here he gives a number of figures to make more explicit what he has been discussing about the limitations of overmind and of the entire mind plane as a reality. And here the telling example he gives is that of a planetary system with the sun in its center. It's a very telling example because it is our own reality. However, it's interesting that as a reality, if we are to take the experience of day, if one was to only live during the day, one would be in an experience in which one could say that there is no night or no darkness that exists, materially speaking. However, if one were to travel out of this particular scheme, one would discover that that is an illusion. Say, for example, just as even at night or in the evening, if somebody were to grow up indoors and never know that there is something outside a illuminated room which is using the power of electricity to create light, one would never know that outside there is something called darkness. Similarly, an overmental transformation may create systems that lived in a relative truth. Now, this entire idea is, you know, philosophically related to two very important debates. One of them has to do with the question of were individuals to be liberated, have spiritual enlightenment? Is there anything like a universal condition that will remain? So certain schools have tried to answer this question by saying that whatever we experience as a universe has no independent reality outside of what we create through our own subjective realities and their synergy. It is like a collective hypnotism, in other words. That is one way of looking at it. But the other side of the debate is that the universe has an independent reality, a cosmic reality, in which individual realities count for very little. See, this is the other side of the debate. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that there is a truth to the universe as a separate and independent reality. However many individuals became enlightened, quote-unquote, there is also the fact of the principle of universal reality that has its own right of existence and its own right of illumination or its lack. Okay? So this is one of the problems of the overmind, that, you know, it can illuminate a variety of relative realities, but it does not ultimately change the universal condition of this cosmos. The other debate that it lends itself to is this debate between the absolute and the relative. And overmind is something that is pitched completely at the border between the absolute and the relative, but it looks towards the relative. In other words, its reality is a reality of relatives. There is nothing absolute in the existence of the overmind. Everything that it projects, everything that it illuminates, is a certain figure that has independent right of existence. So out of a inconscience or nescience, as he's using the term over here, nescience is lack of sense, lack of consciousness in that sense, but you know, nescience has more to do with the awakening of sensation, and inconscience has to do with the awakening of consciousness. Both are actually the same, but it's just another formulation of the same thing. So on this basis of the inconscience, giving the inconscience the right of existence, that is like the dark polarity of things, which always remains to swallow everything up. This is ultimately in the great debate that takes place between the Buddha and Mara in the enlightenment of the Buddha, where the final assault of Mara is one in which he, after everything else is over, he challenges Buddha by saying, ultimately, I, death, have right over this universe. And whatever you may say or do, there was no power greater than me at the origin of the universe. This is ultimately the cry of the inconscient. The Buddha challenges this and asks the earth to bear witness to his own existence as being superior to that of death. This is a very profound moment, because in a way he's saying that there is a power that transcends death. But the Buddha's solution as the power transcending death is ultimately not a power that transfigures death. It lets death remain, again, as a universal condition, but no longer as an individual condition. See, the consciousness goes beyond, but the universal condition remains the same. This is why Mahayana Buddhism has to invent the idea of the Bodhisattva, who will answer to the universal condition that will presumably be overcome when the last human being attains enlightenment. But even there, it is really the notion of a collective hypnotism which is being addressed. Ultimately, if the universe has reality outside of every human subjectivity, we have to allow for some power which is superior to the power of relativism, and absolutism has to intervene. And that is exactly the point that he's making over here, that overmind, even in its highest pitch, is ultimately a power which answers to relativism. And out of something greater, the power of absolute transformation must see all as figures of itself. The one in all must be seen to transfigure this entire cosmic reality outside of subjective and objective.
So Sri Aurobindo is also saying that, right? That there is something, an independent reality, which is not prone to subjectivity, correct?
Yes, absolutely. He is saying that. And we can compare what I just said about the debate between Buddha and death to the debate between Savitri and death. Because there exactly the same problem is addressed. And in the problem between Savitri and death, all these arguments are rehearsed. And at the end of it, there is a transfiguration of death that takes place by the power which is absolute and, you know, the one reality there is, recognizing itself in everything, including the inconscience and nescience. Inconscience and nescience was not the original power. It was given form to allow a certain kind of reality to emerge, and that form can be withdrawn by the power of the giver of that form, which is the real idea behind this evolutionary universe.
So at that point, death is not aware of its own relativity. Is that the reason, or?
Exactly. So death is not aware of its own relativity means that essentially, again, it's a mask. It's the ultimate mask in which the reality of spirit has been so suppressed that, you know, it's the ultimate taboo to allow it to emerge in itself. And this is you know, death seen as inconscience, sure, death seen as exactly what we were talking about, beyond all subjectivity, the hard reality of a inconscient material universe. So that problem is ultimately addressed through only something which is superior to the cosmic condition that can reawaken in it that which it is truly, a figure of, and hide in its depths. As you know, in the Veda, the death or Yama is ultimately a power of the sun, of the sun god, the solar god, which is a symbol for supermind. And, there is an entire hymn, or rather a myth, of the seven sons of, meaning the children of the sun, which are also suns, S-U-N-S, of which one of them is a dark sun that travels down into the inconscient. And this ultimately is death. It is Martanda in the Vedic legend. But ultimately, this is the sun of the supermind in the depths of matter, which awaits its hour to radiate the inconscient and reveal itself as the transcendent power or truth of the inconscient.
Devashishtha, there is this line here, the supreme power of the principle of unity, taking all diversities into itself and controlling them as parts of unity, which must be the law of the new evolutionary consciousness, would not as yet be there. And this law of the new evolutionary consciousness, which basically deals with the principle of unity, is the law of Vishnu that you were referring to, right?
Absolutely, exactly. If this is the law of Vishnu, which must be the new evolutionary principle, and this is ultimately the supramental law, which would not be in the overmind. Overmind doesn't have the power to express that, except as a relativism. That would also be a relativism, which could exist along, coexist along with other relativisms of strife, relative harmonies, isolated unities, etc. For that to create a universe which is secure as the truth of reality, truth of things, you would need higher intervention of the absolute.
And this issue about death being a relative reality, I mean, in a metaphysical sense, it's just true for our physical evolutionary universe, right? Because the principle, the spiritual principle of non-existence always remains a spiritual principle. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. That is also absolutely true. Non-existence remains a spiritual reality or a figure of the infinite, because the infinite is so infinite that there will be ranges of it that will never be experienced, and that is best thought of as non-existent. But nevertheless, what is being called the law of Vishnu is a transfiguration of manifestation in which this is known and experienced, and yet it is the emergence of the continuous emergence of existence from within non-existence that becomes the law of the manifestation.
So, this is my last question or comment. In an earlier paragraph when he was talking about that overmind cannot dynamize the transcendence. So, essentially all the previous realizations, say that of the Buddha, was still at the overmental level. Would that be right?
Yes. The only possibility that we can sort of say that may go beyond that is that because the Buddha does not really comment about what is happening beyond his experience of the cosmos or of the condition of death, let's say, is that there may have been a transcendence which does not choose to transfigure, does not choose to dynamize, itself in the ignorance. This is also possible. But, you know, whatever it is, it's a power that sort of gives the necessary and sufficient condition to overcome death, not to challenge it in any way, you know, or its existence in any way in the cosmos.
Thank you. Devishishta, Devishishta, do you think what Buddha said at that time and the way Buddhism is today, is it the same thing or is Buddhism also evolving? Because there is a lot of talk of transformation and things like that. So, do you think it's evolving, Buddhism?
No, I do think it has evolved a lot, Monica. In fact, you see, the thing is that what exactly Buddhism is today is almost impossible to really put a finger on, because so many different branches have emerged. And also within all these branches, there are so many different kinds of solutions that are being given. Some of the original sort of texts and ideas are retained. But even there is a lot of, you know, different interpretations that have emerged in recent times. And partly the reason why Buddhism has assumed such an importance in modern times is because it is atheistic. You know, in other words, it doesn't necessitate belief in any personal God. And at the same time, it opens itself to a variety of experiences which, you know, take human beings beyond the ego. So given these two fundamental tenets, a lot of spiritual reality has been integrated into contemporary Buddhism, which is what has allowed it to become so popular and so complex in a certain sense, so that one can find much in it that maybe didn't exist in it before.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Devashishda, would you say that, I mean, following up on the last question from Monica, would you say that, that's generally not true of Buddhism alone, like what you said, that it's not clear what it is? Because nowadays it seems that most practices have some form of universalization where they pick things from other practices too, isn't it?
Yeah, there has grown a tendency in that direction. Because also partly of this, greater inclusiveness, of the contemporary world, you know, availability of knowledge, and also there are a variety of other factors which have increased the sense of the universality of being human. That sense has grown a lot more. It is more difficult to deny the fact that we are all the same human, all same kind of beings, same kind of consciousnesses. So that has happened, I'd say, in many different ways. Christianity has expanded. Islam, in its more enlightened formulations, has expanded a lot. Various sectarian formulations of Hinduism have expanded. Judaism has expanded. But at the same time, I think coincident with this particular movement, drive, exists its opposite, where a lot of narrow fundamentalist movements have also emerged that claim their right to be the only truth. I think both these have emerged. In Buddhism, this has happened much less than in the other religions, partly because it has always taken on a kind of agnostic view regarding ultimate reality. I think from the mental point of view, Buddhism has a much greater sort of foundation in certain purity of practice, of disciplinary practice, allowed it to retain this kind of, freedom from fundamentalism. But at the same time, there are various spiritual aspects. The aspect of the Ishvara, for example, that Sri Aurobindo is talking about, that has received, inadequate treatment in Buddhism. Hmm.
So what you're saying is that one of the advantages, so to say, it has had is that it doesn't have many of the controversial elements which contribute to integrality.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. I mean, because it has steered clear from some of these. You see, integrality may be experienced at a higher level after a certain purification of the lower experiences have taken place. Buddhism has tended to steer in that direction. It's as they say, the Buddha never distinctly or definitely pronounced on the existence of a truth beyond the borders of the relative. In other words, if one arises beyond the relative, what exists there? Does anything exist there or does nothing exist there? He never pronounced on that, So one of the most famous, conversations with Ananda during the last hours of the Buddha deals exactly with this idea, where he's asked, so are we to take it that God does not exist? He's actually asked, tell us once and for all, does God exist? And he says, you have been with me for 50 years, O Ananda. Have you ever heard me say that God exists? And he says, no. So shall we take it that then God does not exist? And he repeats the same thing. He says, you've been with me for 50 years, O Ananda. Have you ever heard me say that God does not exist? Uh-huh. And they say, no. And that's when he leaves the body. So that's the agnostic attitude through which, there is a certain purity that is maintained within the ignorance, which cannot pass judgment on these things beyond a certain level of experience.
Thank you, Devashista. Janet, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Sure. But can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Over mind and its delegated powers, taking up and penetrating mind and the life and body dependent upon mind, would subject all to a greatening process. At each step of this process, a greater power and a higher intensity of gnosis, less and less mixed with the loose, diffused, diminishing, and diluting stuff of mind, could establish itself. But all gnosis is, in its origin, power of supermind, so that this would mean a greater and greater influx of a half-veiled and indirect supermental light and power into the nature. This would continue until the point was reached at which overmind would begin itself to be transformed. Into supermind. The supermental consciousness and force would take up the transformation directly into its own hands, reveal to the terrestrial mind, life, bodily being, their own spiritual truth and divinity, and finally pour into the whole nature the perfect knowledge, power, significance of supermental existence. The soul would pass beyond the borders of ignorance and cross its original line of departure from the supreme knowledge. It would enter into the integrality of the supermental gnosis, the descent of the Gnostic light. The descent of the Gnostic light would effectuate a complete transformation of the ignorance.
here he is looking at this entire process as having its foundation in supermind. So this entire ascending scale that he has talked about, reaching up to overmind, from a certain point of view, could be seen as inevitably leading to supermind. So long as we don't limit ourselves over here, and we use the power of the overmind to transform to whatever degree possible mental, vital, and physical existence, we find that the preparation is made for an even greater working to intervene. This is the point he's making. The real problem with each of these levels having any basis in our existence is that there is such a big gap between the kind of existence in these levels and the operations of functioning of our psychology, and physiology. Both the physiology and the psychology are so alien to the operation of these levels that it becomes impossible for any of these to operate directly in our nature. But that's exactly the reason why the whole scheme of ascending evolution that he's talking about follows this double movement of ascent and integration. That is, at every stage that something is experienced, that is then dynamized in lower levels to whatever extent possible. That will never complete itself until one reaches supermind, because there are, you know, inadequacies in the ability of these other planes to directly influence the lower parts of our existence. But as he says over here, once overmind has prepared the ground, one finds that all these planes ultimately are drawing their consciousness from the supermind. Overmind and its delegated powers, that is all the planes of cosmic mind that he has talked about, higher mind, illumined mind, and intuition, are in each case not only being mentally received, but having their partially transformative or modificatory effects on our emotions, on our will, and on our physical functioning. So that's why he's talking about penetrating mind and life and body, dependent upon mind. That much of these, of the body, for example, of the life force that is dependent on mind can be transformed. Not beyond that, because there are aspects to our vital existence and physical existence that are not dependent upon mind. But whatever is, would be transformed to that extent, would be penetrated, and as a result, gradient, this cosmicized, directly at the level of the emotions, or directly at the level of the will or of the body, we'd understand by the law of that particular kind of consciousness what cosmic consciousness means. That is a necessity if we are to emerge into a supramental consciousness. So once that has happened, then higher intensity of gnosis, less and less mixed with the loose, diffuse, diminishing, and diluting stuff of mind, can establish itself. So that's why he's talking about this preparation ultimately opening itself gradually to the direct action of the supramental gnosis. So he's talked about an overmental gnosis, and now he's talking about a supramental gnosis, which is one might call the knowledge will of the supermind. That directly acts on the overmind, transforming it, and as a result, transforming all the other planes of existence directly. Now, along with it, this whole scheme of the triple transformation is one which rests on the psychic being. This individual person that we are ultimately unites with the cosmic person. This is what is happening. The psychic being of the soul of the individual, which is the true person inside us, gradually emerges, unites with the cosmic Purusha. That's when the sense of individuality becomes personalized. And then that moves into its union with the supramental Purusha. So this is why he says the soul would pass beyond the borders of the ignorance and cross its original line of departure from supreme knowledge. That original line of departure is essentially what divides the knowledge and the ignorance, vidya and avidya, and creates that cosmic reality that beyond subjectivities of individuals maintains a certain right of its own ignorant existence. So crossing that line, that the individual Purusha, you know, unites with the Purushottama, the integral person, and that integrality makes possible the operation of new law in the cosmos, not only in the individual. That's why he says it would enter into the integrality of the supramental Gnosis. The descent of the Gnostic light would effect a complete transformation of the ignorance. It makes it possible. One person's complete triple transformation makes possible a transformation of the conditions of universal ignorance, not merely a relative change, but an absolute change in the very law of cosmic existence.
There is that famous popular line in Savitri which goes to that, right? One man's can still save the world.
Yeah, one man's perfection still can save the world. Yes, that's exactly what is behind that particular line. Of course, it is not to mean that everybody will suddenly wake up one day to find that things have changed. That is completely the antithesis of what that line is saying. But basically, what it is saying is that it compels the universal conditions to start creating the conditions under which individuals may undertake the disciplines necessary to move to the realization of the supramental reality.
And that's because that transformation by that one person itself is opening up these planes which now act on the conscious, on the earth consciousness, so to say.
Yes, quite. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the master key is what he's calling over here the supramentalization of the overmind. So this idea of the supramentalization of the overmind is ultimately a transformation of, you know, I was earlier talking about the projector and the power that is acting through the projector. The overmind is really what Sri Aurobindo calls the prajnana in its veiled condition. Transformation of the overmind would mean that the prajnana shakti of overmind ultimately becomes the prajnana shakti of supermind. In other words, not only does it know as a form of consciousness that it is a projector, but it also knows that it is the one being that is projecting itself through it. That knowledge is the transformation of overmind that ultimately allows direct action of the one being in all its manifold differentiations. And then that leads to direct action of supramental shakti at every level of the manifestation.
When you were talking a little bit earlier about the perfection of one man can then transform the world, I was strongly reminded of how the Christian model can fit into that very precisely.
Yeah, it does, Janet. In fact, you're quite right, because I think mystically this is exactly the Christian model, you know, and later in more contemporary times, people like Taylor de Chardin have enlivened that model. He has used the term Christogenesis, for example, in which what he really means is that this supreme person, again, the idea of the Purushottama, the supreme person, is what is evolving in the universe. Christogenesis is the evolution of the supreme person, which might occur even in one person, but in occurring thus, it's the unity with that one person who is behind every person, who has become everything in this universe. And therefore, through that, there can be a transformation which takes place completely in the entire universe.
So, if there are no more questions, shall we stop for today and continue next week?
What was the name of that person, Ashish?
Sorry.
That's Teilhard de Chardin. Are you familiar with him?
I'm not.
Okay, I'm going to type the name into the message section. He was a French mystic of the Jesuit, actually, to start with. Can you read that?
Yes, I have heard. Yes, I haven't read anything by him, but I have heard of that. I have heard of him.
Right.
Is there a book in particular that you would perhaps recommend of his to start with?
Maybe next time I can make some recommendations. There's a few good books and also a very nice book on him, which I can give references to. But I need to look at my references and then give you the names.
Okay.
Shall we stop here with a brief meditation?